today at the City Club. We welcome Jeremy Rifkin, author of 14 books on the impact of scientific and technological changes on the economy, the workforce, society, and the environment. His books have been translated into 15 languages and are used in hundreds of universities around the world. His last book, The End of Work, is an international bestseller credited with helping to shape the current global debate on technology displacement, corporate downsizing, and the future of jobs. His provocative new book, The Biotech Century, Harnessing the Gene and Remaking the World, which Business Week says asks important questions that biotech raises and the industry typically ducks, will be available for signing and your purchase after the forum. Mr. Rifkin has consulted with heads of state and government officials around the world, and he has testified before congressional committees on issues from the proliferation of germ warfare and threats to the labeling of genetically engineered foods. His successful litigation has ensured responsible government policies on a variety of environmental, scientific, and technology-related issues. Mr. Rifkin's unique insight and critical social commentary have landed him on television news programs, Face the Nation, Crossfire, Nightline, McNeil Lehrer, NewsHour, 2020, Larry King Live, Firing Line, Today, and Good Morning America. And he has been in newspapers, magazines, and journals, Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, Business Week, Forbes, The New York Times and New York Post magazines, Science and Scientific American. His opinion articles often appear frequently in USA Today. Mr. Rifkin holds a degree in economics from the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School of Finance and Commerce, and a degree in international affairs from the Tufts University Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. The San Francisco Chronicle calls him a brilliant thinker, a powerful writer, a shrewd debater in public and in print. The American Library Association calls him a seer. Please join me in welcoming the founder and president of the Washington-based Foundation on Economic Trends and one of the 150 people the National Journal has identified as most influential in shaping federal government policy, Jeremy Rifkin.
Good afternoon, everyone. We are in the midst of a fundamental transformation, one of the great changes in history. We're moving out of the Industrial Revolution and into the biotech century. For the last 40 years, two technology revolutions have been operating essentially on parallel tracks, computers and gene splicing, the information sciences, the life sciences. In the last few years, they've begun to fuse together to create a powerful new technological and commercial revolution that's going to remake our entire civilization. The computer is merely a prelude to the new economic era, and the new economic era is based on genetic commerce. The computer is the language, the organizing tool to decipher, download, organize, and manipulate genes. And genes are the raw resource for the biotech century, just as metals, minerals, and fossil fuels were the raw resource for the industrial century just passing from view. Let me try and place this tremendous change in an anthropological context. This shift in the next 50 years will be as fundamental as the shift from medieval agriculture to the industrial way of life. It's going to force all of us to rethink the social contract. For thousands of years, we've been burning, forging, soldering, melting, and heating inert material from the Earth's crust. We've been using pyrotechnologies, fire technologies, and we've refashioned the Earth using fire. We've created steel, glass, cinnabar, cement, synthetics, and plastics. The culmination of the fire technology era is the industrial age, the burning of fossil fuels and nuclear power. In the 1970s, two biologists did something in the world of biology that some are equating with the fire technology revolution in its impact and import. Boyer and Cohn, University of California and Stanford, they took slices of genetic material from two unrelated species and stitched them together. They recombined them, creating the first new novel life form ever at the hands of human beings. Now, instead of burning, soldering, forging, and melting inert material, we can now stitch, edit, sequence, and recombine living material across the expanse of the biological kingdom. I've had people say to me in the past, well, Jeremy, isn't genetic engineering just an extension of the kind of tinkering we've been doing with nature since the dawn of the Neolithic Revolution 10,000 years ago? We've been breeding and domesticating animals and plants for a long time. My answer, quite simply, is no. This is a qualitatively different revolution. I'm going to give you a few experiments that could never have been done by Luther Burbank or any other classical breeder in history. Years ago, at the University of Pennsylvania, scientists took a human growth hormone gene, They microinjected that gene into mice embryo. The mice were born with a human gene replicating in every cell of their body. The mice grew twice as fast and twice as big as any mice in history. And they passed that human growth hormone gene into every generation of their offspring. We now have mice with human genetic material in their blueprint. You cannot do that in classical breeding. We've never seen that in classical evolution. Experiment two, a bit more whimsical. Scientists took the gene that emits light in a firefly. They micro-injected the gene into tobacco plants, the genetic code. Those plants light up 24 hours a day. Don't ask me why they did that experiment. The third experiment is a little bit more bizarre. Sheep and goats, two completely unrelated species genetically, they cannot mate. In the laboratory, scientists took the embryonic cells from each of these animals, fused them together, and gave birth to a new species on Earth called a geep. Half sheep, half goat. The head of a goat, the body of a sheep. A chimera, a new composite creature. And finally, you're all familiar with Dr. Wilmot's clone sheep. We actually missed the real story behind this. We were so interested in talking about when this will happen with humans. And by the way, if we haven't already done it somewhere, the cloning of a human being is likely any time. It's no longer a theoretical issue. It's just a question of who's going to do it. The real story behind the sheep is that Dr. Wilmot created the prototype for bioindustrial design. He's the Henry Ford of the biotech century. It is now possible to replicate in countless numbers exact copies of an original living creature with the same kind of quality controls and engineering standards we did using mass production and assembly line factory work with inert material. That's what's so important about this animal. We move from the industrial age to the bioindustrial age. Genetic engineering is called genetic engineering for an important reason. And it's that second word, engineering, that we all need to heed. It's taking engineering principles and applying them to the genetic blueprints of life. What are engineering principles? Quality control, predictable outcomes, quantifiable standards of measurement, efficiency and utility. Now we're talking about actually applying those engineering standards to the blueprint of life. We're on the cusp of a technology revolution, unprecedented in history. Scientists and life science companies can now become the architects of our own evolution and begin to re-engineer a second genesis, creating new kinds of creatures that have never existed and reformulating the genetic prints of those already here. This is the most radical, daring experiment in our history. There are tremendous potential benefits to this revolution. We have in front of us a promised cornucopia. New foods that could feed a hungry world. New sources of energy when the oil spigot runs dry. Energy from living microorganisms. We could create new fabrics and materials using genetic engineering, new pharmaceuticals. We could find new ways to eliminate the crippling diseases that have haunted our species. But with all of these great benefits in store for us, a nagging question remains. At what cost? Will the artificial creation of cloned, chimeric, and transgenic animals mean the end of nature and the substitution of a bioindustrial world from the laboratory? Will the mass release of thousands and thousands of genetically engineered life forms into our biosphere cause genetic pollution and irreversible damage to our planet? What are the consequences to the global economy of reducing the world's gene pool to intellectual property, so that all of life is the patent of inventions of life science companies? What will it mean to live in a world where our children are customized at conception, engineered to our standards, and as they grow up, increasingly discriminated against based on their genetic makeup? What are the risks in attempting to create a perfect human being? Let's take a look at some of these issues in more detail. You may be surprised to know the following. In the next 7 to 10 years, virtually all 100,000 or so genes that make up the blueprint for our species will be identified and targeted and isolated. And virtually every single one of those 100,000 genes that make up the human race will be claimed as the intellectual property of a life science company. They're claiming patents on thousands and thousands of human genes today. Imagine the power here, unprecedented in commercial history. Corporations that are able to control and own the blueprints for our human race, dictating the terms upon which our future evolution depends, and making that arbitration in the marketplace. Dr. Wilmot, who cloned the sheep, parenthetically, his company, PPL, has submitted an application to the U.S. Patent Office for a patent to cover not only the process for cloning the animals, but every animal that's cloned will be considered his patent invention. And one other thing, he has included in his patent human embryos, cloned human embryos, as patented inventions. I hope you all heard this. Regardless of where you stand on right to life pro-choice, imagine the profound ethical issues here, and perhaps constitutional issues, when the patent office, and they probably will give him this patent, will we give him a patent so that all cloned human embryos will be considered his patented products? We thought we'd resolve this issue in 1865 when we decided with the Emancipation Proclamation, you cannot claim another human being as your commercial property. But now, the same issue is coming in the back door in the form of patents on life. The patent office says, look, you cannot claim a human being as your commercial property, because the 13th Amendment to the Constitution forbids slavery. But you can patent all the individual human genes, the human chromosomes, the human cell line, the human organ, the human tissues, the human embryo, and the fetus. None of those are covered by the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. And now companies are scouting the planet in search of rare genes in microorganisms, plants, animals, and indigenous human populations, because genes are the raw resource for the next century. Whoever controls the genes controls genetic commerce. When they locate these genes, they patent them. The mergers and acquisitions and consolidations going on in the giant life science industries dwarf the mergers going on in telecommunications, entertainment, and software industries. Does that surprise you? It's just we hear very little about it, and here's why. Our futures have done us a disservice. For 15 years, our futures have written books preparing us for the information age. So that's where we're focusing our debate. Calling the next century the information age is like calling the modern age the print press age. Neither are resources. Both are forms of communication. The print press was essential as a new form of communication to organize a society based on steam power and coal. The computer is not a resource either. It's a form of communication to organize a new economy based on the raw resource of genes. So what I'm suggesting here is that we're woefully behind, we in the public, where this whole revolution's moving. We have not been prepared by our media, by our academic institutions, and by our politicians. Yet this technology revolution will more intimately affect our lives than any in the history of humanity. How we date, who we marry, how we have our children, the foods we eat, the kind of work we do, even our perception of life will be dramatically affected by this revolution. Let's look at a few of the issues. You're going to hear a new term, genetic pollution. In the next 20 years, the life science companies are going to be introducing thousands and thousands of genetically engineered, laboratory-conceived organisms into our biosphere, mass-propagated over all the ecosystems of the world. We're already introducing thousands now. Microorganisms to eat up toxic waste. New genetically engineered plants in our fields. Millions of acres this year have grown with the first genetically engineered plants, all in the last year. Now, when you introduce a genetically engineered organism into the environment, it's not like introducing a chemical product. These products are alive. They're more unpredictable. They reproduce. Chemical and nuclear products, for all the problems, do not reproduce. And genetically engineered organisms migrate. They proliferate. How do you call it, recall to the laboratory a genetically engineered microorganism, bacteria, virus, or plant, if it runs amok and causes damage? How do you get it back? Imagine the scale here. Thousands and thousands of introductions all over the world of genetically engineered life forms reseeding the Earth with a second genesis, all in the next 20 years. Ecologists, environmental scientists use an analogy. Introducing these new life forms is like introducing an exotic species from a native habitat to a new habitat. We've brought a lot of exotic organisms over to North America. Some have fit in, and some have become pests. You're all familiar with kudzu vine, Dutch elm disease, gypsy moth, starling, Mediterranean fruit flies. These were not native to North America. We brought them here, they ran amok. Every time we introduce a genetically engineered organism into the biosphere, it's a tantamount to playing ecological roulette because there's no history with this species in these environments. If just a small percentage of these introductions run amok, the genetic pollution to the next century could rival or exceed the kind of pollution we have faced with petrochemicals and nuclear products in the century just passing. And you and the business community and taxpayers should know here, there's no insurance against liabilities. The insurance industry has said we won't insure any of these releases of genetic organisms into the environment against catastrophic damage because there's no way to know what's going to happen, so we can't assign risk. There's no science to judge what's going to happen. So here's an entire new era in history, genetic commerce coming into our society, the floodgates opening, the biosphere being reseeded, no insurance. Who's going to be held liable when the first genetically engineered organism runs amok? Taxpayers? Consumers? Unanswered questions. When I raise these issues, I hear deafening silence from the life science industry. Genetic pollution is just one issue. We also have to introduce the social implications. There's a word here that no one in the industry wants to talk about. It's called eugenics. You older people here will be very familiar with this term. Eugenics is the philosophy of using genetic manipulation to improve an organism or to create a perfect species. When we think of eugenics, we normally think of the Holocaust, Nazi Germany. Hitler's dream to create the Aryan perfect human race. Although, as was suggested by the introduction in the quote from the 1920s, we should understand that we supported a massive eugenics movement in this country from 1900 to 1930. Two out of three colleges taught eugenics, how to create the perfect race. 70,000 Americans were sterilized by state law because they were considered inferior biologically. And we even passed an immigration policy in the 1920s, shameful, shameful policy, in which we kept out of this country those we considered a poor genetic stock, bad blood. That immigration policy lasted for a half a century. Eugenics is inseparable from the new genetic technology because the whole point of genetic engineering is to improve an organism, to improve a species. Well, who decides what is a good gene and what is a bad gene? Right now, thousands of laboratories, corporate, government, academic, around the world are changing around the genetic code of life from the lowliest microorganisms to human beings. Who decides what is a good and bad gene? How many here would entrust the federal government to decide what genes should be engineered in and out of evolution over the next biotech century? Let it be recorded for those listening in on radio. Silence. How many here would entrust the scientific community to decide what is a good and bad gene? How about the life science corporations? How about consumers in the marketplace? All of us would be very distrustful of giving this ultimate power and authority over the blueprints of life to any institution. However, if I asked you another question, how many of you would like to have the option of some of these new opportunities in the biological marketplace? You might likely say yes. Example. In the next 7 to 10 years, we will be able to identify thousands and thousands of genetic traits. You can come into a doctor's office now and be screened for hundreds of genes and genetic predispositions. But in 5 to 10 years from now, you can go into that doctor's office and be screened with a DNA chip for thousands of genes. This is going to create a fundamental break in the parent-child bond in history. If you're a prospective parent, if you're a teenager listening in right now, and you're going to have a child in 5 or 10 years from now, you and your spouse will be able to take a DNA chip genetic screen test and know exactly what you're going to pass on to your child before conception. You will actually have a crystal ball which will allow you to look into the genetic future of a child not yet conceived. Well, what do? If you know you're going to pass on the gene for childhood leukemia, wouldn't you want to program that out of the egg and sperm before conception as a parent? What if you knew you were going to pass on cystic fibrosis? Well, where do we stop here? What if you knew you'd pass on Alzheimer at around 50? Or you were going to pass on a predisposition for manic depression or for alcoholism? What if you were going to pass on poor vision or color blindness or dyslexia or the obesity gene or short stature? What parent wouldn't want the best, healthiest child that money could afford? You know any parent that would say no to making these changes in the sperm and egg if it could improve the prospects of the children not yet here? On the other hand, once we begin to program our offspring, it becomes the ultimate shopping experience. They become the architectural design that we've pre-programmed for them. And once we begin to see the sperm and the egg is riddled with errors, on the other side of that coin is some ideal norm of the perfect baby. What is that perfect baby? What should it look like? Who decides? And what if you're the beneficiary? What if you're the child who is programmed with those genes and constrained by the genetic blueprint your parents set out for you? The intergenerational conflict may be quite interesting. How likely will it be that we'll be tolerant of those who are not genetically engineered, who may have disabilities, who may have, quote, defects? Are we likely to be more or less tolerant of those among us who don't conform to the engineering norms that we set up? So what I'm suggesting to you is that the new eugenics is not social eugenics. We don't have an evil cabal of political ideologues trying to force us into the brave new world. The new eugenics is banal. It's market-driven. It's based on consumer desires. We've met the enemy, and it is us. What parent wouldn't want the best for their child? So these are very heavy issues. In the book, in the Biotech Century, I try and make very clear that there are tremendous benefits and tremendous perils involved in this technology revolution. I also try and make it clear just because it can be done doesn't necessarily mean it should be done. And one can be in favor of this science, as I am, and still believe there are different ways to harness it technologically that may do less harm to future generations. Let me deal with one more social issue which already may have affected somebody in this room. You're going to hear another term in the next few years, genetic discrimination. It's already here. In the Biotech Century, in the book, I have a survey by Harvard University. They've already seen widespread genetic discrimination by employers, insurance companies, adoption agencies, and schools. Employers screen you with blood tests for their health insurance plan. Do you know everything they're screening for? Employers may want to screen you to see if you have a genetic predisposition for cancer. They may not want to hire you. If you get cancer on their watch, it's going to be more health costs for their company. A company might want to know if you have a genetic predisposition for diabetes. They may not want to put you on the corporate fast track and spend a lot of money on you if you will be disabled and can't work to full capacity. Well, let's get this one step removed. What if you were hiring for an air traffic controller? Do you want to know if he or she has a genetic predisposition for manic depression or alcoholism? Here's where the discrimination comes in. Even if you have these predispositions, you may not manifest the disease, and even if you manifest it, it may be controllable. And there may be others who become manic depressed or alcoholic or get cancer because of environmental triggers. The gene is not all powerful. The gene interacts with the environment. The predispositions can be triggered. For example, we know diseases of affluence like cancer, heart attack, diabetes, strokes. We all have different genetic predispositions for these diseases, but we also know that if you are a smoker and a drinker, and if you eat a lot of fatty meat, and if you don't exercise, and if you live in pollution, it's likely you're going to come down with those diseases. So where the discrimination comes in is when institutions simply look at your genetics and say, aha, this person's a problem. Now I'm going to kind of step on some territory here that may be a little delicate. Let's take attention deficit disorder. We have begun to genetize young people all over the country with various genetic links to mood and behavior, the most interesting being attention deficit disorder. We have millions of youngsters on Ritalin. Now, be clear, certain children are born with a genetic predisposition for attention deficit disorder, but it is also possible that the fast-paced, nanosecond culture with all the stress and anxiety that we put them in could help trigger those genetic predispositions. But what's become fashionable now is to forget nurture and just concentrate on nature and say if that child has an attention span problem in first grade and there is a genetic predisposition, that must have been the problem. And therefore, we don't have to deal with the environment or change the values of the culture, just simply give that child a drug. You're going to see another term in the next few years, genetic rights. Increasingly, as people become victims of genetic discrimination, and this discrimination is going to be more virulent than racial discrimination or religious discrimination or even ethnic discrimination, when this becomes more apparent, people are going to demand genetic privacy. You and I are going to say, we ought to have our genetic information. It's valuable to us, but no institution should be able to have this information without our expressed approval. Genetic rights will loom in the next century as important on the political agenda as human rights and civil rights have on the century just passing. Finally, this new genetic science is invaluable. We're learning a lot about genes, how they function, how they turn on and off, how they express themselves, how they relate to their environment. The question is, how do we apply this science in a way that creates a renaissance and not great social and ecological upheaval? We are risk takers. We are tool makers. We're moving ahead into this biotech century. How do we proceed? What's the rule of thumb? The first rule of thumb in medicine is first, do no harm. When choosing among alternative technologies to use this science, always choose the alternative that's least likely to foreclose opportunities and options of those not yet here. Not only our own species, but all the fellow travelers, the other creatures we coexist with and steward on this planet. So first rule of thumb, do no harm. Second rule of thumb, when choosing different technological approaches to the new science, always pick the approach that's the least likely to do radical harm and the most conservative. Take the technology option that's the most likely to sustain rather than drain our relationships to the rest of the biosphere. Good rule of thumb. And I'll give you an example of how this works out in practice. Genetically engineered foods. The first genetically engineered crops are being grown in the fields in the U.S. this year. Monsanto has genetically engineered soy growing over millions of acres this year. And Sibagagi has genetically engineered corn. It's coming into your supermarket. Unfortunately, it's not labeled, so you don't know which foods have those strange genes in them. You see, these new foods that are genetically engineered have genes in the foods that have never been eaten in the diet of the human race. Hamster genes may be in some of these crops. Some of them have petunia genes. Some of them have firefly genes. The Monsanto crop contains a gene called Bacillus thuringiensis. It's a toxin taken from a bacterium. And they use these various genes to develop plants that are pest resistant or viral resistant or more nutritious. Sounds good. The problem is we don't know what will happen to the environment when we place these plants out there. And more importantly, when you eat these products containing genes from non-food sources, we don't know if you're going to have an allergenic reaction because you've never consumed genes from a hamster or from a firefly. Interesting enough, there's so much concern in Europe that the same food companies that are producing the foods here and not labeling them, they are beginning to label them in Europe because the consumer says, we want them labeled. Now, the reason I mentioned genetic foods is we could use the same new genetic science, all this tremendous new information we're learning about the gene, to create an alternative soft path agriculture, organic, sustainable, and an agriculture integrated with the ecosystems of the world. We could learn with the new science the subtle relationships between genetic predispositions in existing plants and how to make them more compatible with local ecosystems. Instead of genetically engineering the plant and bypassing evolution, we work with evolution and steward the environment so that you can buy at your store organic, sustainable, fresh foods that don't do harm. Soft path. Medicine, same situation. We could use a hard path, a soft path approach. We could wait until you get sick and then use the new genetic engineering therapy to pump genes into your body to make you well. Or even more radical departure, we could change the sperm and the egg, all the genetic instructions, and eliminate these diseases. Do you want to eliminate all these recessive traits that create disease? We learn in biology that every species has a wide range of genetics so that they have a big enough pool to accommodate changes in environment and in evolution. If you monoculture an animal or plant, so there's only one or two strains of variety, you risk great disruption. You're all familiar with the potato famine in Ireland. One strain of potato, it was not immune to a particular fungus. A lot of people starved. Did you know that the sickle cell anemia recessive gene prevents malaria? We just located cystic fibrosis, the recessive gene that we now believe prevents typhoid and cholera. If we began eliminating all these genes for medical advance so that the next generation is healthier, is it possible in the long run we'll actually program our own extinction? There is a soft path approach to medicine. We could use the same genetic science and create a sophisticated, market-driven preventive health to keep people well with the science so they don't get sick. We know, for example, that 70% of the diseases that we're likely to get are diseases of affluence, the heart attacks, the strokes, the diabetes. We also know that if we can help ameliorate the environment, change our habits, we're less likely to get these diseases. We're going to be able, in a few years from now, when you eat a piece of food, we'll be able to actually trace how the genes turn on and off when they metabolize a piece of food. So we will actually be able to pinpoint the relationship between the genes, how they express themselves with the food we eat. We could also be able to test ourselves against the various types of exercise we use or environments we're in. This is tremendous information. So instead of a radical approach to medicine, actually beginning to redesign the blueprint of our species, we could use this science not to re-engineer ourselves, but to make our environment more conducive and healthier for all of us. So, I'm going to leave you with this last thought. I've had an interesting series of debates with a scientist by the name of Lee Silver at Princeton. I respect him, but we disagree on so many things. He has suggested that what we may begin to see in the next century is the development of what he calls a genotocracy in the biotech century. Those parents who can afford to program superior genetic traits in their children will do so. And after generation, it will be these children and their heirs genetically who run society. He calls them the gen rich. The others in society, the gen poor, they're going to have to procreate the old-fashioned way because they won't have access to or be able to afford these new technologies. He said eventually, These two groups, the gen rich and the gen poor, will be so different from each other genetically that they won't even be able to mate and will create two new subspecies. And the gen rich will have as much in common with the natural human being we know today as we have with our nearest relative, the chimpanzee. And lest we take this too lightly, remember, we share 99% of our genes with the chimpanzee. We only have a 1% differential that makes us a human being. So Lee Silver's vision of a genotocracy is not too far down the line of possibilities. So last thought. I wrote this book, The Biotech Century, on the eve of this new century because I wanted to encourage a robust debate, a great public debate. The greatest contribution of this new genetic science, it's going to force our generation and our children's generation to ask the big questions once again. What is life? What does it mean to be a human being? Is life just genetic codes and blueprints that can be patented? Or does life have intrinsic value, not just utility value? What's our responsibility to future generations? What are our obligations to our fellow creatures that we coexist with? Should we play God in the laboratory? Or are there other ways to use this genetic science that are more humane and civilized and create opportunities rather than foreclose options for those not yet here? So I'm hoping that the public can come up into this debate. We are very far behind. The developments going on, I work with business leaders and CEOs all over the world, and I can tell you the developments going on in the life science industry are so fast. They're moving so quick. They're so far advanced from what the public understands that we have a great gap here. The public needs to be informed in discussions like the one we're having today, and then you and I need to be engaged. We cannot leave these decisions only up to the scientists in the laboratory or the executives in the corporate boardrooms of the life science industry, because these technologies should not just be arbitrated in the marketplace. They affect all future generations. If this isn't the technology revolution that we discuss broadly and intimately, which one will we ever? So my hope is that beginning in the next few years, we can begin to engage this great question about the future of our evolution. How do we move into this century of genetic commerce? And how do we begin to engage this daunting new science in a way that will benefit our children and create a renaissance rather than great upheaval for future generations? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Today at the City Club, we are listening to Jeremy Riskin, author of the provocative new book, The Biotech Century. We will return to Mr. Riskin in just a few moments, but first a few announcements. We welcome you to this City Club Friday Forum, the longest continuously free speech forum in the country. Our greetings go to those who are watching locally on WVIZ, Channel 25, WCLV, or to one of the 389 radio outlets across the country in the City Club's radio network that is generously sponsored by the Eaton Corporation. Now it is time for our traditional City Club question and answer period. We welcome questions from everyone, including guests. Jim Foster holds the mic in the front, and Patty O'Brien holds the mic in the rear. First question.
Before today's program, someone asked me about you. I had occasion to hear you speak about 20 years ago. I indicated that I felt in 100 years from now, when we were all gone, except for some of the students, that they would be reading about you. Based on what you talked about, the genetic engineering, what will a form of the City Club be like 100 years from now?
Well, it's my sincere hope that this new genetic science can be an invaluable asset, not only to our species, but all the other species that we coexist with, that we'll do the right thing. You know, occasionally, in turbulent times when there's great changes in society, generations are called upon to do the right thing. Sometimes they heed the call. Sometimes they miss the call. We have a window of opportunity that's closing, an opportunity for us to begin to sort out these very, very complex, heavy issues. I don't know of any scientific and technological revolution in history that raises more important environmental, social, and ethical issues, and I'm sure most of you would agree. We need to engage that debate, and if we can, maybe in 100 years from now, we will have used this science in a new way. instead of using it in a way that isolates and detaches and is used just for power, we use it in a way that helps us connect, we establish our relationships to each other and our fellow creatures, and helps us heal this biosphere, this beautiful biosphere we live in. That would be a very nice and a beautiful legacy to hand on to the next century.
Yes, welcome to Cleveland, and back to the future, brave new world. My question is going to deal with something that has been in the news constantly for the last 2 days, that should make us worried about more about the gods in the executive suites as opposed to those in the laboratory.
Why do I know what you're going to say? Go ahead.
Why don't you say it?
Is this about Viagra?
Absolutely not.
Oh, good. All right. All right.
What is Viagra?
Oh, okay.
No, I want to talk about. I'm going to talk about Chrysler being like the mouse story you told. Chrysler being injected into Daimler Benz and making it three times as fat and three times as ugly. The ultimate crap shooter in the world stock market, Kurt Kerkorian, is reported to have netted $524 million in stock increase with this most recent move. The question is, what impact will this huge merger have on the economies of the world and on the environment?
Well, let me say that while this is an incredible merger, there was another merger discussion that took place 2 months ago that would have dwarfed the merger between these two auto manufacturers, and the only reason this other merger broke down is because of the egos of the CEOs. There was a merger that you didn't hear much about, and that is GlaxoSmithKline was in serious merger discussions with Smith, Kline, and Beecham. And the deal would have been a $165 billion company. That's a lot bigger than the merger between these auto companies. It would have been the largest merger in history. And even though that failed because of the egos of the CEOs, they couldn't decide who was going to be top man after the merger. These mergers in the life science industries need to be looked at. They're much more profound. And when you get a lock, when the handful of life science companies get a lock on the genetic blueprints of life and can be able to control the actual biology of the planet, that's far more serious in commercial terms than the mergers going on in traditional manufacturing industries, because that's the future. In the book, in the biotech century, I think the most chilling quote that I have in the book is from Bill Gates. Bill Gates says, it's about information, and the most important information we're deciphering now is genetic information. Bill Gates, Wall Street insiders like Michael Milken are pouring money in to this new field called bioinformatics to bridge the information in life sciences, to bring the computer and gene together into a single powerful revolution. And when we began to see the information companies coalesce with the life science companies to control both communication and the biology of the planet, we are definitely into a very serious new geopolitical era. We need to be aware of that in the public and be vigilant.
Excuse me, but you did interrupt me, so I'll interrupt you. You didn't answer my question.
Well, it's not relevant to the biotech discussion today. I'd be more than happy to. As you know, I wrote a book recently called The End of Work, and the book, if you read it, deals extensively with these kinds of consolidations. I worry about them. I worry about the consolidation, whether it be in the manufacturing and traditional industrial categories or in the new information and life sciences. They're all about creating more control, more concentration of power in fewer institutional hands with less accessibility and less input by the public.
I was concerned about your comment on the patent office having apparent jurisdiction over the genetic processes. I was wondering whether this jurisdiction by the patent office is established by precedent or has it been unchallenged?
Well, let me tell you the story, because I was involved in the Supreme Court decision that led to this. There has been no legislative guidance to this decision by the Patent Office. There was a Supreme Court case, you may recall, in 1980. General Electric created a microorganism to eat up oil spills. It was genetically engineered. They went to the Patent Office to get a patent. The Patent Office turned them down, saying you cannot patent life. Life isn't covered. It's a discovery of nature. Patenting this, they said, would be like patenting the chemical elements in the periodic table. You can patent the processes, but how could a chemist in the last century claim helium or oxygen or aluminum as their patented property just because they isolated it? The same would hold true with genes and organs and tissues and whole organisms. They're not inventions. Well, GE appealed the patent office decision, and to the surprise of Washington policymakers, the Customs Court of Appeals, by 3-2, said you can patent this organism. They called the three judges that went for the patent said, we look at this organism, and it looks to us like a composition of matter. And here's the key line for everyone listening in on radio. The three judges said, this little microbe looks more like a detergent or a reagent than a horse or a honeybee. Any biology student in this room could tell us that a bacteria is alive. It is not a composition of matter. The two judges on the other side were aghast, saying, this is not more like a detergent. It's a living organism. It went to the Supreme Court, and by 5-4, the Supreme Court upheld the Customs Appeal Court. My organization provided the main amicus curiae, along with the Patent Office. We were the other side. We argued you can't patent life. It's a product of nature. Justice Berger, in his decision, called our amicus a parade of horribles. He said, you're suggesting that this will open up a much broader area for patents. He said, this is a narrow decision. Justice Brennan, the late Justice Brennan, led the four judges on the other side, our side, warning not to do this because this would change policy and this is a legislative matter. Unfortunately, we were right. 7 years later, the U.S. Patent Office, without any legislative guidance, without any Federal Register notice, issued a simple four-sentence paragraph saying anything that's alive on this planet that's genetically modified can be the intellectual property of a company with the exception of a full human being. That's the history of it. We need to revisit that history in the courts. You need to revisit this history in Congress. I just bumped into an old friend of mine, Congressman Kucinich, who I haven't seen in years and years, on an airplane in a town. And Dennis, if you're listening in to this show, you said you were going to today, we need members of Congress to begin holding hearings, to begin taking a look at this whole question of whether you can patent life. Certainly the American public ought to have some input as to whether the blueprints of our species and the genetic blueprints of the rest of evolution ought to belong to life science companies.
Mr. Rifkin, I believe I heard in the news just within the last couple of weeks that you yourself, as a matter of fact, and another gentleman, have recently filed for a patent involving a process, for the creation of human-animal hybrids of some sort.
Correct.
Why did you do that, and what's your intention?
Well, I joined with a distinguished cell biologist who some of you may know, Stuart Newman, at New York Medical College. We worked on this for 5 years. We felt it was necessary now to intervene into the process at the patent office to establish new precedent. We have sought a patent, and it's a very sophisticated patent, that would cover all human-animal composite creatures, chimeras. That is, the fusing of human embryonic cells with the embryonic cells of chimpanzees, primates, pigs, any other animal. We fully expect to get this. I should tell you, we didn't do the experiment because under the patent laws, you don't have to. If the technology exists and you can show it's possible to do it, you can submit a patent just on new applications and ways to use it without having to do the experiment. We never would. We think it's unethical. But the reason we've done this is we fully expect to get this patent. And when we do, we're going to establish a genetic conservancy to make sure no researcher in the world can use it for 20 years. Because we will control it, it would mean it's out of commission, no one can use it. We have to do this now because several patents already pending are dovetailing on human-animal chimeras. And in the next week, you will hear new information about some of our, a few of our major research institutions who are actually on the verge of doing what we've just done. We want to make sure that every country in the world has the time to reflect and hopefully pass legislation to prohibit these kind of human-animal chimeras on ethical, moral, and environmental grounds. So we've done this to give every nation that 20-year breathing time so that the public can be engaged in this debate. Parenthetically, if we lose parts of this patent, and I suspect we won't, but if we do, we have automatic review all the way up to the U.S. Court of Appeals. We're going to revisit this court case of 1980 and make new law. We've done it because Congress didn't act. We've done it because our elected representatives have dropped the ball. Their responsibility on behalf of the people in this room were to say what is morally acceptable and what is inappropriate in patenting life. And I would ask all you parents here just to keep this one thing in mind. Will your children be better served or worse served in the biotech century? If they grow up in a world thinking of all of life on this planet as patented inventions and the property of some company. Imagine the disservice we do to the intrinsic nature of life when we so reduce it to utility that it's all just a matter of property that can be owned and manipulated. I don't think the benefits are worth the long-term psychic damage to future generations in their belief and understanding and perception of the value of life.
Mr. Rifkin, in your introduction, you paralleled the Industrial Revolution to the upcoming genetic revolution. And you mentioned that the effects, just as the effects of the Industrial Revolution were both positive and negative, so would the effects of the genetic revolution. How do you propose our government plans to deal with the inevitable problems that the genetic revolution will produce?
Alyssa, is it?
Yes.
Okay. The petrochemical and nuclear revolutions brought great benefit to society, but we didn't ask the tough questions up front. We were so giddy with the possibilities, we rushed open the floodgate without any questions being asked. The result is your generation is saddled with many environmental, social, and economic problems as a result of our refusal to take our responsibility to ask the tough questions up front. My hope in writing the Biotech Century is that we have a forum now to ask the tough questions up front. We can never look back and say we didn't know, we weren't aware. And what we need to do now is not only understand the potential benefits of this new science, but we also have to measure those benefits very, very carefully against the potential perils, the risk to the environment, the risk to society, the risk to our concept of the intrinsic value of life. And we need to be willing to entertain the idea of saying no to parts of this technology revolution. If we're not willing to entertain no to parts of it, then why even have a debate? There are some listening in who will say, look, if it can be done, it will be done. It's a fait accompli. Learn to live with it. That's an escape. That's a cop-out. Human beings make choices based on their values as to what kind of technologies we feel are appropriate to have as part of our lives. And we darn well better make sure that we make those decisions correctly when it comes to this science, because it's going to affect the basic evolution of this planet.